Good day, fellow explorers. This is what we have for you on today's Impact Everywhere podcast.
If you take away prison programming, you take away arts, you take away theater, you take away education, basically you just have people in cages. So the arts are very important. And due to many reasons, mainly probably economic, the bare bones of programming is given by the prison. Anti-violence program, sex offender programs, and GED programs. So college programs, arts programs, yoga, things like that are supplied by volunteers.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Impact Everywhere, the podcast that looks for people having a positive impact in unexpected places. Our guest today is Susan Slotnick. She's a visual artist, a choreographer, a dancer, a writer, and an advocate for social justice. Susan recently released a book called Flight, The Dance of Freedom, and her publicist reached out to me by email asking if I would be interested in hosting her on my podcast. I receive a lot of requests for people to come onto this podcast, oftentimes from individuals that are more entrepreneurial, trying to sell a service or trying to build up their credibility as a speaker. But this one felt very different because Susan is a retired artist and really for the last 16 years has spent her time teaching dance to inmates, volunteering inside of different correctional facilities. And the purpose of her book was to basically pave the way for anyone else who was interested in bringing the arts into prisons. And that is a cause that I can get behind. And so I invited Susan onto Clubhouse to have a conversation about the various lessons that she's taught over the years to her students, as well as the lessons that she's learned from those that she's taught. I hope you enjoy this week's podcast. This is Susan Slotnick, and here she is explaining how she got into working into correctional facilities in the first place.
I was searching for that all of my life, asking the great philosophical questions. Why was I born? What am I supposed to do? What is the nature of this place? And how do I fit into it? And I had no idea that when I went into the boys' prison, that was going to be my moment to have achieved for myself answers to the great question, what am I supposed to be doing? From the second I walked into that prison, from the first moment that the boys lifted their arms and I had taught them how to stand, and I had said to them, when you move in dance, you move like you're displacing water. If you can imagine swimming underwater, your movement is not airy, it's fluid. And you have to use muscularity and resistance. One boy raised his hand and said, we're from the hood, we don't know how to swim. But they got the idea anyway. And I said, okay, imagine you're moving through pea soup. And when they lifted their arms in the first moment that I saw them, and they were all wearing red, and they lifted their arms, and I think the first piece of music that I played for them was the Boys Choir of Harlem singing Amazing Grace. And they were so profoundly beautiful in the most unexpected ways and had so much dignity and so much sense of presence that I actually, within the first 5 minutes of the class, had to walk out into the hall because I was tearing up. And I immediately knew that something about working with incarcerated populations was going to allow me to meet my need to find my sense of self-actualization. And those boys provided that for me.
So beautiful. And can you tell me the first time that you realized the power of dance?
When I was a young person, I had a very rough time, although I was growing up in what would have been considered a privileged family and in a privileged environment in Westchester, New York. My mother was a borderline personality disordered person, and my father was an autistic savant. My father memorized a 250,000 record catalog numbers if he saw the record once. He had a record store in Manhattan called Merritt Music Shop. And I was unhappy, and I was doing very badly in school, and I was acting out in various ways. And one of the ways that I started to act out was that I took a lot of risks with my own safety. And when I was 18 years old, even though people thought I was really tough in school, because I would have been considered a juvenile delinquent type when I was in high school, I flunked out of high school. I got into a car with a known bad boy, and the evening ended with a date rape where I lost my virginity because I was actually a big fake. I was actually a very innocent person, even though I had a persona to cover up my pain. After that rape, I came home. I never told anybody. Of course, in those days, I blamed myself. but I felt so sad that I decided that after my parents went to sleep, I would put on music, and in my pajamas, I would go into the living room and I would dance. And I danced to The Drifters over and over again, singing a beautiful song about love called Some Kind of Wonderful. And by morning, I was over the incident. I know that sounds very strange, but actually, in terms of evolutionary biology and research, it is now a known scientific fact that if you move smoothly, beautifully, like you're underwater swimming, that it changes your brain chemistry. This is a medically known fact. And the brain chemistry that gets changed is exactly the same way that Prozac works, and the feel-good chemicals in your brain are released when you dance. And as a result of that experience, every time I was sad, every time I was disappointed, every time I had a failure in life, of which there were many, I would dance. And at that juncture, I was not a trained dancer. I was not a trained dance teacher. But later on in life, through a number of circuitous events, I did eventually become a dance teacher. And I did eventually, when it was too late for me to be a professional performer myself, I eventually did train to be a teacher in the Lester Horton technique, which is the technique that the Alvin Ailey Company originally was trained in. And I knew that I wanted to work with people who needed healing. Now, most people in prison, most men and women in prison, are victims as well as perpetrators. Some are just victims. We do lock up innocent people. And knowing that they were victims and that they did not have the freedom to move freely, I believe that dance would be a perfect tool for the healing power that they needed and deserved.
As someone like you who's gone through so much trauma in life, you've managed to keep this really humble way of phrasing it, where you take this adversity in life and you turn it into something beautiful, but you don't really give yourself credit for that. Could you expand a little bit on why that is?
I do give myself credit for that. I don't take credit for it. There's a difference. When I was writing my book, I found my diary from when I was 12 years old, and I was looking through it to see if there was anything in there that would be useful in writing the story of my life. And I came upon an entry that said, literally, "My mother hates me. I'm flunking every subject in school. I have no friends. Why do I believe in myself so much?" At 12. Now, years later, I was hired by the Osborne Society to teach parenting in prison. And one of the lessons was on resilience. And the reason that I don't give myself the credit for it is when I was teaching that syllabus, part of it was that resilience is a heritable quality. It's like having blue eyes. Some people in a family, some children are resilient, some aren't. I was born with a propensity towards resilience. So that was dumb luck. So therefore, I can't pat myself on the back for it. But I'm very proud that I had the chance to overcome the things that I've overcome. And I actually believe, although it's not a very popular opinion, but I've seen it too many times, that people who have been through adversity at a young age, and it can be adversity of loneliness, even if you have a great family, it can be the adversity of a physical problem or anything. If you experience adversity as a child, the possibility for growth, for wisdom, for dealing with discomfort, for developing resilience, and it can be encouraged and developed in people, even though it is partially or even maybe primarily a heritable quality. But you can engender it in your children as best you can. So I believe I had that. I was lucky enough to have that. And I also wanted so much. I think each person in life has a wish for themselves. And I think that wish is very strong when you're a young child. You wish for things when you swim. You wish for things when you see the moon. You wish when you see flowers in the spring. But I think as you get older and people tell you who you are, you grow to believe it. And as you believe it, it develops like a crust over your wish, and you lose sight of your wish, what you wished for as a little child, because you start to believe the things that people tell you're incapable of. For me, my wish remained through most of my life and most of my failures I remember this like it was yesterday. I promised never to hit my kids. I promised never to forget the African-American people that I saw marginalized when I was in junior high school. I promised never to forget what happened to the Jews during World War II. And I would promise that I was going to be a better parent. And I would promise that I was going to try and make the world better. And that promise happened every night when I was 18. And it was a manifestation of a wish that I had managed to keep alive in myself. And when I would work with the prisoners or with all my students, I would try to find a way to encourage their wish. Now, whether or not you can use this or not, it's very clear to me that you have a big wish in your life. And I believe in something that the Gurdjieff work called magnetic center. It's an esoteric belief, and it's not usually my thing, but I've seen it in action so many times that people who wish for themselves for a meaningful life, for being useful, they attract to themselves, like a magnet, other people with the same wish. They will attract what they need to eventually find their own path to self-actualization.
What do you think it was about your life that enabled you to connect with inmates in ways that others at that time especially were just not able to do?
There was one gentleman that when I came in told me after, I think I worked with him about 5 years, he said to me, "You weren't like any other volunteer that came in. Most of them come in and we can tell they think they're helping the have-nots. They're here to be the great white hope, or the person who's educated, went to college when we didn't, or the free person, and we're not free. And we never got that vibe from you. We always felt that you walked in realizing you were there for yourself. You were there to give your skills, to give your life meaning, not to save us. And nobody ever saves anybody. Anyone who thinks they're saving someone else's life, that is narcissism at its worst. People save their own lives." I used to say to the men, because they would sometimes call me guru or they'd want to put me on a pedestal. And I'd say, "Don't put me on a pedestal. It's a very shaky place." And I would say to them, "Here's what I'm doing. If I give you great tools to build a house, and those tools are given by somebody with great teaching ability and talent for inspiring you to use those tools, and you build the house, who built the house? The person who gave you the tools or you?" And that was something I made very clear to them, that I was going to give them an experience that they could take and run with. But in the final analysis, whatever it was, the dance or the philosophy that I taught, which was based on the Gurdjieff work, whatever they did with it was 100% on them. Because some of them ran with it and to this day have utilized it every minute of their lives. And others, once they got free with all the distractions of being free, really reverted to a lesser state in terms of their inner desire for change. And that's not something that I'm criticizing them about. Out here, there's jobs, there's parole officers, there's parental problems, there's illnesses, there's problems with their children. And not everybody can maintain their greatest wish. If you're in a monastery, one, you're in the monastery. And in some ways, a prison is a strange kind of negative space monastery, but gives you some of the same opportunities for reading and for introspection. Sometimes that becomes permanent in somebody in the monastery, and sometimes people have that as an experience and take it forth into their life, but don't utilize it to the same extent. Therefore, how could it be me that changed them? Because if it was me that changed them, I would have changed all of them in exactly the way I wanted to the same exact degree, which did not happen.
Now I'm curious, how do you know in that case then whether or not you're doing a good job? Like, how do you know if you've given them the right tools or if your tool needs to be improved?
Everybody's tools need to be improved. Nobody's a saint. We're all imperfect people. Sometimes I talked at one point about the line between when you work in a prison, those men are wonderful and grateful, and you get a lot of your own needs met. So you have to watch very carefully the line between having your needs met and meeting their needs. And you've got to stay very vigilant about that and can't slowly have your desire when you go there to say, tell them something you're unhappy about. Just because they were so nice to me, I never did that. If I told them something about myself, it was in their service. I'd like to tell them, "I wish I could have a little bit more time with you today because I'm feeling sad." But I would never do that. I would never encroach my needs on theirs. And when you're in the helping profession, that line gets crossed very easily. So I was very cognizant of that. And I knew I had faults, and I knew that I could succumb to my own ego or my own needs being met. So I became, due to the grace of having been in the Gurdjieff work, which is 99% self-observation, I had enough presence of mind to be observing myself and to make sure that I didn't use them in any way for my own ego. Nevertheless, I had a movie made about it that won at Cannes Film Festival and two documentaries. And they used to send me Mother's Day cards filled with love. And I still hear from them, a lot of them, and they tell me how much I did for them. So how do you get that kind of appreciation and still not allow it to change the way you're working with them? And that was something I was intellectually aware of the whole time I was there.
And so for people who want to do good in the world, but would maybe not have been trained in the same way that you have been trained, what are some questions that they can ask themselves, some practical tips to ensure that they're not being self-serving about their service?
Know why you're doing it, what you expect to gain. What are the pitfalls in your own personality or your own need structure, which are areas that could get you into difficulty? For example, it's almost inevitable that young, attractive women who may have had some disappointments in relationships will be in a room with men who adore them and are grateful to them and who they can't be worried have only interested in them for their body or for a sexual relationship, because that's impossible in that situation. So if you go in needy and you don't know you're needy and you've been wanting a certain kind of loving male attention all your life, that could be the beginning of a minefield. Now, we can extrapolate that to almost anybody doing anything. Men working with men, working with children. Very important to watch that line where your own, I don't know what the word is to say, your own imperfection, and there's nothing wrong with imperfection. Imperfection is a beautiful thing and we all have them. But to watch that line where your own weaknesses, for lack of a better word, because I don't think weakness is a bad thing because we all have them. But to watch that line where the good that you could do can be encroached upon by your not being aware that you're meeting your own needs rather than the needs of the people around you. And that's hard because you get your needs met as soon as you try to make the world a better place. You get your needs met tenfold. There was a study done on what brings people happiness. And of course, they found out that if you have nothing, no food, no water, no shelter, and you get that, you're going to be much happier. But then they found out that when you have enough money, you're secure. To becoming a multi-billionaire, there's no happiness differential between those two things. None whatsoever. I guess the point being that in the Harvard study, what they found out brings people the most happiness over time is gratitude almost more than anything. And of course, the obvious relationships that are working. But another factor is people who think what they do is caring for other people. That is the secret of happiness. So you go into a prison and no matter what's been bothering you outside, you're so happy. You're grateful. You're grateful to use your skills. You're grateful that they're grateful. You're grateful for the opportunity. You feel like what you're doing really matters. And you get so much happiness out of it yourself. That line can be crossed so easily. I'm there to make myself happy. No, you're not there to make yourself happy. You'll be happy as a byproduct.
Well, I can definitely speak for myself and say that I am generally happiest when I know I am in service of someone else. It gives me a lot of purpose and direction and meaning. So couldn't agree more. When I think of prisoners in prison, which is a fairly rough environment in which you're trying to survive or you're trying to be strong, dance feels kind of at the polar opposite of that. So I guess my question is, how do you go from taking a group of people who are incarcerated, who are maybe in a fight or flight kind of environment, at least that's my stereotypical view of it, and get them to be vulnerable in this place of motion and dance and to lean into that potential that it holds without being prescriptive about it? I feel like there's a little bit of a gap there. What do you do to close the gap?
I don't think there's a gap. It's not my experience that there's a gap. My experience with myself, with everybody I've ever met, with them, is that everybody wants to let out their true self. Everybody has a deep spiritual need for authenticity. Especially in an environment like a prison, they'll jump at an opportunity to be real, to be beautiful, to be strong and soft at the same time, to feel compassion, to make contact with themselves, not in their persona. A prison is a place where, in order to survive, you do have to have a persona. By the way, it's a prison out here where, in order to survive, you have to have a persona. It's maybe more in difficult settings, but we all have that. We all have a dance between our public self and our private self. And I would say to the boys, I think on the first day, I would say to them, who are you in the mess hall? And they would say who they were. And I'd say, and who are you alone in your cell at night? And they would really recognize the difference between authentic self and persona. And I would tell them, this is an opportunity for you to be your authentic self and be seen non-verbally, and be seen doing something so real and so beautiful that everyone watching you becomes their authentic self too. And I would say that happened every time we did a show for the whole 15 years and in every class. There was people ready and wanting to be true and to be beautiful and to be kind. There was that need. And then the class was over and they would become their personalities again, and so would I.
Wow. So then I know that you put on these concerts and these shows where family could come and see them in a completely different light. So I guess this authentic persona itself, what were some of the reactions from the family members or outsiders who may have known them in a completely different context?
The only time family was allowed to come was the boys' prison. And the boys, 12 to 18, from the inner city in New York primarily, they had babies, a lot of them. We heard for many years about unwed mothers in the hood, for lack of a better word. The unwed mothers had an unwed father, and the fathers wanted to be good fathers. They actually wrote me letters about wanting to be good fathers that are published in my book. So sometimes their babies came, and they were so desperate to see their babies, and their parents came. And there was one time that a parent got up and said, I love you, my son. But in your whole life, I never had a chance to be proud of anything you've done until this moment. So that was an audience experience from the boys' prison. From the adult shows, I had a lead dancer in the Paul Taylor Dance Company. This dancer got up, who was about as high as you can get in the dance world. It looks great on paper. And she was in tears. And she said, this is dance. And it's been many years since I've seen it. They were brilliant. And on the website, you can actually see them dancing. And yeah, you won't believe it. Did you see them dancing?
I have. And it's absolutely stunning to see.
It's stunning.
Yeah.
And so the reactions were unbelievable. And then there were a couple of people who wrote articles about it in publications. There were people who decided they wanted to go into prisons and do arts. But the one thing I can tell you that really helped me was the confluence of the influences. The Holocaust, the civil rights movement in the late 50s, the adversity I suffered in my life, the sexual abuses I had suffered, the bad parenting, the people who loved me and saw something in me, all these things, and especially the work in the Gurdjieff work, all of these things came together. And by the grace, I was able to engender very quickly bringing out the best in these people. It's hard for me to say this because I don't want it taken out of context, but there have been other people that have gone into prison and tried to do what I did and did not get that reaction because all of those very special circumstances came together and seemed to just ignite in what was exactly the right thing to get them to do what they did. Because I wasn't just teaching dance. I was teaching mindfulness.
That's so cool. I'd love to talk a little bit about what happens once people graduate from your program and get out into the real world. How does that affect recidivism rates? How do you know if you've been successful or not?
Well, again, I have to say it's not me who's successful. It's me who's good at what I'm doing, but they're the ones that create the changes. So in terms of recidivism, first of all, by the time a man, a grown man in prison, a lot of them are very big because they do a lot of weightlifting. By the time a man is willing to get up in front of the general population, the rest of the prison, and do modern dance, he's 98% rehabilitated already, or he's not going to volunteer for a program like that. So I should say that I saw people who were really on a path, a beeline to success getting out. Having said that, a few have gone back. Most of them have not. And I'm in touch with them. When they first get out, I'm in touch with them a lot. I would say almost every day for maybe the first couple of weeks. And then over time, I'm not in touch with them. Some I'm not in touch with at all. Last year, three guys came up here to surprise me and visit me, and that was great. They like things or comment on things on Facebook. But the day they get out of prison, 12 of them said to me, I don't want to go home. I don't want to go to my mother, my wife, my children, because they want the boy to come back who left 20 years ago, 25 years ago. I want to be reborn into the world by someone who knows the man I became. So I had my own little reentry program, which was breakfast at Susan's house the morning that you get out. And 12 men took me up on it and left the prison at 9 o'clock in the morning. Whoever picked them up was often a relative or a friend, came right to my house, which was about 45 minutes away from the prison. I served them their first meal on the outside. We danced in my dance studio. We hugged because you're not allowed to touch them in prison. So the falling out of those rules was a rite of passage in itself. And then they had to go right to their parole officer, report within a certain number of hours. And they were launched from bagels and lox and cream cheese and croissants and cheese omelets and dancing.
Those must have been really powerful reunions.
They were. I have a lot of them on video.
That's amazing.
None of them are on my website, though.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to.
They have their privacy.
I was still working in prison, and you're not allowed to do that. You know, you're that's against the rules. So I didn't want it to become too commercial that I had them in my house. I trusted them completely. I trusted them more than I trust almost anybody. I knew them very well. But you make art with people for 8 years, two or three times a week. You learn their stories. They learn about you. It's an amazing relationship that develops.
You build this really tight relationship with all these people who grow over time to the point where they get released. And invariably, there are a number of disappointments along the way where things don't go as planned. When someone either loses contact with you completely or ends up doing something wrong and ending up back in prison. How do you reconcile with that personally?
It's happened three times. And it's not because they ended up in prison. It's because they hurt me. One man who was somebody that I stood by, and it's a long story. He became very misogynist in the posts that he posted about women. Terrible, fat shaming, overtly sexual posts. And this was not who he was inside. We danced at the National Museum of Dance, and people were so impressed with him that they friended him on Facebook. And then women started to call me and say, do you realize what he's doing? So I had to confront him. And when I confronted him, he became defensive and that relationship ended. So I can say, how do I deal with it? He broke my heart. Then there was a man that I was the closest to. Of all the men and boys that I have ever dealt with, he basically ghosted me and just stopped responding to any kind of overtures whatsoever. And that broke my heart. But years later, I get a phone call out of the blue. It's my birthday. He wants to come up and surprise me. So sometimes what we take personally is really them just moving on, or that things didn't get what I call crystallized in them. We all read a book, or we have a teacher, or we have an experience, or we study something in college, and how much becomes permanent in us. So although inside the dancing meant everything to some of them, the lessons that they learned from me didn't necessarily crystallize. So I've had my heart broken. When you love people, I don't care if they're your students, your husband, your children, your teacher, your doctor, we can be disappointed by each other. And when we're disappointed by each other, it breaks our heart. But what I used to teach my students, I'd say, heartbreak is a really good thing. Because when your heart breaks, it's like a piggyback and the contents can spill out.
It's crazy though, because on one end, you were only able to do the work that you did with the intensity and honesty and transparency because of how much you love them. But on the other, it opens yourself up to vulnerability. how do you draw boundaries when it comes to this kind of work that is so, I guess, consuming?
Well, boundaries are not my forte. I'm the kind of person that just goes the distance, that just sees the need and just tries to fill it. And I'm not necessarily saying that's the best way to be in all circumstances. Whenever you work in a reciprocity situation where you're giving and you're getting back, which is basically when things are right, you have to be very hyper aware of the line of demarcation between you meeting their needs and you needing them to meet yours. So your heart can get broken when the boundary is fuzzy enough where they have started to meet your emotional needs without you being necessarily totally conscious of it. And that's where you get disappointed. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I want to shift gears here and let's just dive like really quick into your book and then we'll open it up to the audience. You wrote your book, Flight, The Dance of Freedom, with the specific intention of inviting more people to get engaged with prisoners and to use their skills and find ways to supporting them. I'm curious, what were some of the biggest mistakes that you made that you hope others won't make when they decide or if they're inspired by your story and want to get involved?
The nitty-gritty of how to get involved in prison is something that I would be happy, if anybody is interested, I can talk them through the steps to try to get inside. Before I answer the question of what I did wrong, I want to say that if you take away prison programming, you take away arts, you take away theater, you take away education, basically you just have people in cages. So the arts are very important. And due to many reasons, mainly probably economic, the bare bones of programming is given by the prison. Anti-violence program, sex offender programs, and GED programs. So college programs, arts programs, yoga, things like that are supplied by volunteers. The biggest mistake that I made, I was going in as this outrageous aging hippie woman, thinking that the staff was the cops. And I lumped them all. I thought they were all stupid. I thought they were all not progressive. I thought they weren't going to care about the men. I went in with a whole bunch of erroneous assumptions. And I would say that's the biggest problem, is if you go into any situation, go in trying to see everybody as an individual.
Very good. And when it comes to risks that you took while you were in prison, which was the strongest, the biggest risk that you took that you don't regret taking?
The biggest risk I took was with the gentleman that ghosted me, and I don't regret taking it, but it's part of the reason that it was so easy for me to become disappointed. This man was wonderful, is wonderful. He graduated from four-year college inside the prison. He mentored a lot of people. He was a brilliant dancer and actor and respected, but he had committed a terrible crime. And he had an infant child, a daughter, when he committed this crime. I'm not going to go into the crime. But when he told me, I actually walked around that whole week thinking, I can't believe he did this. I don't know if I'll ever be able to feel the same way about him. But I worked on myself and I did. When I came back, he was coming up for parole and he wanted me to help him, which was not allowed, with his parole hearing. Help him with mindfulness, help him with how to talk, what to say, how to present himself. So we were working together with that. He had been in prison for so long that the infant daughter finally turned 18 and he wanted to find her. He didn't want to find her to necessarily make contact with her. He just wanted to know if she was okay. Now, we are not allowed to get in touch with family. We're not allowed to call family on the phone. But this man really, at that particular point, after I think that was about 8 or 9 years into seeing him 3 times a week, I felt we were friends and I felt I knew him very well. So I did some searching for his daughter. I did not find her, but that was the biggest risk I took, was breaking that rule.
And just to pause a second on this moment where you were working through whether or not you could forgive this person and see them, like, how did you do that? Because I think this is something that us as human beings, we go through life, we get mad at people. I know for me, I get mad at people for really mundane things and then I can't really get over them. So what was that process of forgiveness? Are there any lessons there that you can share with us?
Well, I was angry at somebody very recently, within the last 48 hours, that hurt me. Somebody that I love very dearly, someone in my family. And I was on the verge of getting in touch with this person and telling them how they made me feel and trying to point out what they said that really hurt me. And I felt attacked and all of this stuff that we go through as part of the human condition. And I just went and talked to a friend, and the friend asked me some questions. What do you want to gain in this situation? What is your ultimate heart goal? And in the course of thinking about it and shedding some tears, which is my default setting, I forgave the person and never bothered to really confront them, but totally forgave them because I love them. Letting it go. We walk around offended a lot of times by life and by people, and people are so imperfect. And sometimes I can do that. Oh, believe me, most of the time I can't do what I did in the last 48 hours. But if the person's not that important to me, it's very hard for me to let it go because I'm not a saint. But if it's your mate or your family member or a close friend, sometimes you just have to sit down and say, what is going to be gained by my confronting this person? Am I just trying to vindicate myself? And if you are, let it go.
I love that. That's great. There's something that you said, Susan, around how the successes that you've had have made you more humble as a person, right? Getting recognition for the work you've done in a prison, in prison or for so many years has made you more humble. Why is that? Because I think oftentimes when we think of success, it's inversely correlated with ego growing and it's the opposite effect. What is it in your case?
That's an interesting question and a little bit of a difficult one. I will tell you that, I don't know if this is quite humility, I'll answer it in two stages. When I look at my website, you know, when you've been in pain, there was a little girl, her name was Susan Meltzer, not Susan Slotnick. And I grew up with people telling me I had a low IQ, and I grew up with people telling me I'd never amount to anything. And I grew up with numerous sexual abuse, varying severities, not too bad. And often the incidents were only once. It wasn't a horror story that was ongoing, but it was scarring. And I believed in myself regardless. I look at my website and I sometimes the humility comes up in me and I go, really? Susan Meltzer really did that? So I'm in awe that I was able to accomplish as much as I did given who I was. So that's the first part. Secondly, when you start to really self-actualize, and I'm not talking about what's on paper, I'm talking about a deep sense that your life has meaning. When I write a column that I think is going to be useful or has meaning, or I do a painting that has meaning or a dance that has meaning, I think, wow, I'm so lucky that I got to do that. Well, feeling so lucky is a humble feeling rather than saying, I'm so great. Look what I've done. So that feeling of luck, that feeling of by the grace of God, I was able to develop all these talents and I was married to a man for 52 years, that whether I wanted to go into a prison or whether I wanted to paint, whatever I wanted to do, he used to say to me, my job in life is facilitating your growth. That makes me humble. With a different husband, I don't think I would have done any of those things. So the realization that we don't accomplish anything on our own. So when people look, especially young people, because I know there's a lot of entrepreneurial interest in Clubhouse, because I've just looked in a few rooms, a smattering. Even when you look on paper, let's say you graduated from Harvard Law School first in your class, no matter what accomplishments, you didn't do them by yourself. That's what causes humility. And then the coincidences. I really could have been a could have been person if it wasn't for my mother, who was the nemesis of my life, the worst relationship of my life, and still there were blessings. My husband, who we've had problems, 52 years of marriage, you don't not have problems. But had I married anybody with jealousy, anybody that would have said, you're always in front of an audience taking a standing ovation when you mount a show and you're busy all the time and you're in your artwork and I feel like I need more attention. Had I not married this humble, giving man whose philosophy of life is to be in service, I wouldn't have accomplished anything hardly that I've accomplished. So how can I take credit for it completely? I take enough credit for it. I'm proud of the things I've done, but it's not feeding my ego in the way that your question implies.
I love the amount of gratitude you invite into everything that has occurred in your life. So that's really beautiful. Christine, sorry for making you wait so long. I'd love to hear your question or contribution.
I'm so happy to be here, Ben. Thank you. Susan, I've just enjoyed everything that I've heard. I was thinking about a quote I heard recently from a woman who works with kids. And she said that we have to give the grace for people to make mistakes. We have to understand that people do make mistakes and move on from there and not hold them accountable for future decisions, because we all change as people. And I just feel like you've taken that to such a bigger place. And it's just so lovely to hear. I'm just wondering if any of the men that you've worked with, have they gone on to help and to carry on the legacy that you started?
One man did for a little while, and then he stopped. He ran into some obstacles. And he also changed, because they change a bit when they come out. And I don't mean that in a negative. They interface with different things in the world. But many men in prison, not even just in my program, and a number of men in prison that were in my program, did not continue dancing, but a lot of them want to work with the youth. That is a big agenda for men in prison. So here's the greatest story about the dance program accomplishing something both wonderful and also profoundly sad. So I had a student named Dave Navarro. He was from, I don't know what country, he was Hispanic. And when he came to prison 30 years before, he was in prison 30 years, he came as a teenager. I think he was incarcerated at 15 and then sent to an adult prison at 18. He was illiterate. He couldn't read or write. And he educated himself in prison and he became fluent in sign language, and he became the person who did sign language in the prison. And he entered the dance program. And unlike some of the men, instead of the upbeat numbers that were done to hip hop, his favorite pieces were the slow, very emotional pieces. And he loved the dance program and was able to really articulate how he felt about it. Anyway, he was in a prison where the water was no good. And it took a long time for them to figure out that the water was dangerous. And many men became symptomatic and the water was changed and they were given medication. He never had symptoms. So the virus that was in his body from the water stayed with him. And at one point towards the end of the dance program, he found out he had stage 4 stomach cancer, and they gave him a very short time to live. Shortly before he found that out, a documentarian came into the prison to do a radio documentary, and she had a camera with her. And the camera could take videos, and we were not allowed to take videos inside a prison. It was against the rules. And I strong-armed her into taking a picture of him and the other men doing the first movement from Alvin Ailey's Revelations, which I re-choreographed for their ability. The piece is about, I've been rebuked, I've been marginalized, I've been hurt, and look who I am, look how beautiful I am, the way that I move and the way that I dance, which was Alvin Ailey's intention. So this was a place where this piece really had meaning. He got a chance to go on parole for an end-of-life parole where they let you out because you're dying. And they turned him down. They wouldn't let him out after 30 years, even though he was dying. They said he was still a risk. I took that video, which was a pirated video, and I sent it to 3 progressive lawyers. They never got back to me. I sent a letter. The next day, those 3 lawyers went to the prison and took his case pro bono, which would have cost tens of thousands of dollars in legal work. They got him out of prison. He called me in the car on the way out of the prison. I could hear traffic. He was with his girlfriend, by the way, who had stuck by him for the whole 30 years. Very shortly after that, he went into hospice. The girlfriend, who I had never met, but had been corresponding back and forth with her about his condition and about the lawyers, all the whole correspondence, by the way, is in my book, is in my memoir. She said, he wants to see you before he dies. Because if it had not been for the prison dance program, he would die in prison. There are 2 wishes. I want to be a good influence in the world when I get out. I do not want to die in prison. 2 days before he died, even a little less than maybe 48 hours, I drove to Long Island to the hospice, met his girlfriend for the first time, and spent next to his last day of life with him. And he died in her arms as a free man because of the prison program and because I broke a rule. And I broke the rule without regret.
Thank you for sharing that. So good. Jurgis, would you like to close us out with a thought?
I'm a big fan of what you're doing, Ben, and actually listening to everything that Susan is talking about was so beautiful, because I at least acknowledge that a lot of these really beautiful initiatives, ideas, programs that now no longer seem like, they don't seem so progressive. 10, 15, 20 years ago, Susan, when you started to do everything you do, were radical, more than radical. I guess they were frowned upon. There was no way people could accept them. And I think that's really beautiful that you're talking together and really speaking about how you open ways, you open channels, you open paths for other people to tread through with a little bit more bravery, with a little bit more courage. And I was just really happy and inspired.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it very much.
All right. With that being said, Susan, would you like to close out on any final thoughts? The name of the book, by the way, is Flight, The Dance of Freedom, and it's available on Amazon.
It's actually, the link is right on my website. You can just click on my website and be able to order it. It's SusanSlotnick.com. Slotnick.
Alrighty. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Susan. That was a wonderful conversation. And for anyone here who is remotely curious, just head over to see the book preview on Amazon. You can see some of the sections in the book that she's wrote, and she writes really beautifully, very vulnerably. And there are just a wealth of awesome stories and lessons to be learned that you can bring into your everyday life, even if you never have plans to go work inside of a prison. So with that being said, folks, you can always head over to impacteverywhere.club, where you'll find show notes, links to Susan's website, links to the book, and all of the music that she referenced. Last but not least, if you're enjoying what you hear, make sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It always helps to have a written testimonial on your reactions, your comments, your questions. And so that's it for this episode. I hope you all have a wonderful week. Stay positive, stay curious, because impact is everywhere.